This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of Stage 9, or maybe it's a very special episode of Commentary, Trek Stars. It can be both.
We're in both timelines. Yeah. We're in both the Prime and the Kelvin timelines of this show.
Exactly. There you go. There you go. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And it's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek when this episode is being released.
Yay.
And we thought we would do something special and kind of do a throwback to what we used to do on Commentary, Trek Stars, and give a recap of a series which we never actually did, but which we probably would have absolutely certainly done next had we continued that show in that format. And that is Brian Fuller. Talk about the work of Brian Fuller outside of Star Trek. As we all know, Brian Fuller is the co-creator and showrunner, or possibly co-showrunner, of Star Trek Discovery, the new Star Trek show coming to you this January on CBS All Access, or Netflix if you live anywhere outside of North America.
Yes.
And we're going to take a look at his pilots for all the other shows that he created, whether they lasted 3 years or one episode.
Yes.
And we're going to see what conclusions we can draw from that, and also talk about what we would pick if we saw all of these pilots, you know, out there, and we were studio executives and we had to green light just one. Which one would we green light? So let's get this started. There are six pilots. I guess we could just list them right now.
Yes.
And then, you know, okay. Dead Like Me, Wonderfalls, The Amazing Screw-On Head, Pushing Daisies, Mockingbird Lane, and Hannibal. All right. So let's start at the very beginning. 2003. Brian Fuller just finishes a very successful run on Star Trek Voyager and decides it's time to create his own television show. And he does. It's called Dead Like Me. And, you want to give a synopsis of this thing?
Dead Like Me is, it was a TV show about Grim Reapers who work in the state of Washington. And it ran for, what, two seasons? And, it follows, Georgia Lass. Is that her? That's her name? Georgia
I think Lass? So. I'm so bad at names. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's the narrator, and she dies and becomes a Grim Reaper, and it's sort of zaniness ensues.
This is the pilot, I think, more than any of the others, that deals with the most earnest issues, I guess. But still mm-hmm. does so in a humorous fashion, you know? I mean, it's you know, you hear the premise and you're like, oh, it's about an 18-year-old girl who dies. And now she has to deal with the fact that, you know, maybe she didn't live her young life to the fullest or whatever. And, you know, that sounds kind of depressing. And at times it is kind of depressing. But at the same time, there's a great deal of humor in it. For example, the way that she died was because a toilet seat from the Mir space station, I think it was, was deorbiting and fell on her head. And, yeah, so she was killed by a space toilet seat, you know? I mean, things like that.
Yeah.
What did you think about the pilot?
You know, it's good. It's so difficult because you sort of have this thing of like, you know, who I was when it came out versus who I am now sort of thing. But I can tell you that viewing it now, it's one of those things where I look at it and I'm like, you know, this is good. It's entertaining, but I wasn't crazy about it. It was there. Like I didn't have anything against it, but I didn't go nuts for it.
So did you watch it when it came out?
No, I didn't watch the pilot. I watched part of an episode. I don't remember which one. It was one of those ones where I remember at the time, and maybe this is memory playing tricks with me, where it got enough positive press, or they did enough good job with pull quotes, that I was like, oh, this seems interesting. And like, I remember turning on an episode and then getting distracted for whatever reason, and like just never going back to it.
Yeah, no, I remember there was definitely a lot of positive buzz about it. There were a lot of people who enjoyed it when it came out. And I didn't watch it because it was on, like, I think it was on, like, Showtime or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get that channel, you know. And, you know, I was really sort of, like, hardcore into movies at that point, too. But I always, like, wanted to see it but never got around to it. But then when Fuller was announced as, you know, the creator of Disco, I went back and I watched the 5 episodes that he was involved with. I think it was only 5 before he left due to creative differences. And yeah, for as far as the pilot is concerned, I do enjoy it. I think that it does some interesting things in terms of, you know, almost coming of age stuff. Like this person comes of age after she's dead, you know. I mean that's kind of interesting. I think the performances are pretty good. It's got Mandy Patinkin in it. He's really cool. Rebecca Gayhart is pretty good.
Okay, look, but saying Mandy Patinkin is pretty cool. I mean, it's like the old Gene Hackman joke. He's good in anything.
Yeah, no, that's true. That is true. But, you know, I it's okay. It's okay. Would I continue watching it? Maybe, maybe not. But I thought it was decent, you know, as I was watching it.
Now, see, that what's so interesting to me though is how can the creator of a show, right, like what happens, how can these creative differences come up so quickly in the run of a show? Like, did you not know? Did he pull sleight of hand and, you know, haha, this is my real plan for the show? Like, how do you have a fallout that quick?
You know, I read a little bit about it, but I don't really know much in terms of specifics. I know that he's said, like, this is the worst experience, you know, creatively of my life. This was, like, a really bad fit. It sounds like he pitched the show to be a certain thing, and the network was like, yeah, do that. And then when he started doing it, the network was like, maybe you could do something different. And he's like, no, I can't, you know? And basically the changes that they were asking for sort of made it clear to him that they didn't really understand what it was he was trying to do and that this wasn't going to work. So he left. I mean, I could be getting some of that wrong, but that's what I've heard, and I don't know any specifics beyond that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, you do hear that kind of thing happen a lot in Hollywood. Like people, you know, they like write a script for a movie, the movie gets greenlit, they shoot it, they edit it, and then the studio's like, oh, I think you need to change that. And it's like, we told you exactly what we were doing. Why right now, after we're done filming it, do you want to make it something different, you know?
Yeah.
So
okay, fair point.
But, you know, I don't know, but he was not happy and he left. And he went off to, even though Dead Like Me continued for another year, he went off to make his own other show called Wonderfalls in 2004. This is a show that he co-created with Todd Holland, who is a television director of note. He's won a few Emmys for things like The Larry Sanders Show and Malcolm in the Middle. And this was on the Fox Network. So, yeah, you want to give a synopsis of the Wonderfall premise?
Well, it was doomed from the start by being on the Fox Network because it wasn't a reality show.
It also had the double whammy of being, I think, the co-show ran or the showrunner was Tim Minear, who had the same position on shows like Firefly. And, you know, so it was
cursed people.
Yes, it was a double whammy. It's like, this is, he, you know, just like Brian Fuller, he creates a show, everyone loves it, and it gets canceled.
Yeah,
in 5 episodes.
Wonderfalls follows a charming woman who suddenly develops the ability to hear things speak to her, and it sort of leads her on the path of trying to set things right. and of course people misinterpreting those things, and again, quirky comedy brought into it, you know, somebody seeing reality from a slightly skewed angle to things. She thinks she's going nuts, but she's not going nuts. She's really developed this ability to hear misshapen pennies and quarters talk to her and tell her special things to go do, and all of that stuff. It's a, you know, it's a, I'm doing a bad job really of selling it, but it's a charming little premise. It really is.
I mean, his shows are so weird that lots of times it's hard to express, you know, what they are and why they work. And, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with sort of like the tone of the pieces, you know, which I think, you know, each of these pilots has its own kind of like distinct tone. And I think a lot of that has to do with like the directors who he ends up working with. In this case, Holland, you know, co-created the show. So it has a very specific tone. And it's interesting to me because it feels like an extension of Dead Like Me in a lot of ways, you know?
Sure.
I mean, like Dead Like Me, it's about an 18-year-old who, you know, is sort of like an underachiever, and, you know, she dropped out of college after like a semester, I think, and then she's trying to get a temp job and she dies, and now, you know, she's given these fantastic circumstances that she didn't know existed, and in a certain way, you know, needs to help people who need help, even if they're people who are about to die, you know? Whereas Wonderfalls, it's about a 24-year-old who, you know, graduated, you know, from an Ivy League school and now is working at a gift shop in Niagara Falls, you know, I mean, again, like sort of an underachiever, but slightly older, you know, and with a slightly different perspective. But she has that same sort of attitude of the character in Dead Like Me, where she's, you know, basically ambivalent to the world around her. And there's this external magical force which makes her care, in a sense, against her will, you know, makes her do good against her will. And I don't know, I personally think that Wonderfalls works better than Dead Like Me, mainly because of the tone, you know. It's not that Dead Like Me wasn't a comedy, but this one is much funnier and much more lighthearted, and maybe because it's not really dealing with death, you know. And I think that it works. I really sort of love the pilot. I think that it's really funny, but also introduces some really cool and interesting characters, and sort of like sets it on this path, which is, you know, delightful and also very much sort of a product of its time. Like I was watching a lot of like television shows in this sort of era, and there were some trademarks, you know. You had like Veronica Mars, and I guess Buffy had just ended and everything, but it definitely feels like that sort of show, you know, that quirky, quirky, like sort of dialogue driven, character driven TV. What did you think about the pilot?
I think it's absolutely charming. I have not watched the entire show, though I do possess it. But judging the pilot just on its own merits, I completely agree with you, where it is a tonal thing, but I think that also there is a chemistry in the cast that sets it a notch above as well. I think that there's an actual real, this isn't actors working together. These feel like who these people are interacting with each other. As absurd as the premise is, and as absurd as some of these situations are, it feels like a real world. And these performers don't feel like actors saying lines to each other. This feels like real people interacting with each other. I mean, that's the only way I can say it. And I think that's what sets it apart, aside from tone.
Yeah, it has a pretty great cast. I mean, the lead was played by Carolyn Davernas. I think I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. But you've also got like William Sadler, Lee Pace, Tracy Toms, you know, I mean, Jewel State shows up towards the end. So yeah, pretty great cast. Of course, you know, it only aired for like 4 weeks or something like that before getting canceled. And the rest of the episodes were released on DVD about, I guess, like a year later or something. And they actually had like a big thing where, like, when the DVD came out, I think the Paley Center in New York or wherever that is had like a thing where they showed all 13 episodes back to back, you know, for people, you know, for the first time, you know, and so quite a following despite its very, very short run on TV. But I did just finish watching the entire series and I did like it quite a bit.
Oh, good.
So this is also just kind of like historically in terms of, you know, Star Trek or whatever. This is the first time that Fuller worked with Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts, who are executive producers on the new Star Trek show and apparently co-showrunners, whatever that means. So yeah, and they wrote some really good episodes of the series. So check that out for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple of years later, a pilot which did not get picked up was released. This came out, I believe it aired on the Sci-Fi Channel. I know it was released on DVD. I remember, for whatever reason, I got it and we screened it on one of my Tuesday night movie clubs. But the name of the show, which lasted one episode, is The Amazing Screw-On Head.
Yes.
Which is based on a comic book created by Mike Mignola, the guy who created Hellboy and all that stuff.
Yes.
And this is an animated show with an all-star cast, you know.
To say the least.
Paul Giamatti, Patton Oswalt, Molly Shannon. David Hyde Pierce, yeah. How could I forget? Some really big names, you know, working on this show. You want to give the premise of this thing?
It's alternate history. It's which in a sense it's kind of like Hellboy in that sense, where it's just you know, if you're familiar with Mignola's work, you know his sensibility, you know his art style, and it's that. It's Emperor Zombie versus the Amazing Screw-On Head, who is working in secret with Abraham Lincoln to battle the forces of darkness. And like this pilot, you find out that the real purpose of the Homestead Act was so that they could fight against the forces of darkness. And the Amazing Screw-On Head is going to help save everybody. And I had fonder memories of this. I really did. But seeing it this time, I was kind of like, oh, well, I got to be honest. This is kind of like phoning it in. This is like a motion comic at best. And it's just like, let's get a lot of big names and just have them say lines. And so, okay, fine. That works. Not really.
I mean, I think it's okay. I really do like the look. You know, they brought Mignola on as the art director. So it looks like a Mike Mignola comic book come to life, you know, and that I think is pretty cool. I like that style, tons of steampunk stuff, you know?
Oh yeah.
And it really does kind of adopt, you know, this sort of style. I think that has become prominent in adult animation where it's just kind of like jokes, you know, just like lots of jokes. And a lot of it is just sort of like, oh, you know, look at this, Abraham Lincoln, and, you know, hey. You know, I thought it was funny. I enjoyed watching it. You know, it was short enough that it held my attention and everything. I guess I did kind of have the feeling at the end where it's like, how could you sustain this for, like, a series? Yeah. But at the same time, I mean, I guess I could see them, you know, I mean, the sky's the limit. You know, so I could see them coming up with a bunch of ideas just as crazy as the one used here, and it could have worked, you know, relatively well. So, yeah, I mean, this was entertaining, but ultimately I think a diversion in a lot of ways for Fuller. Although it is interesting to see him work in sort of like a completely different, you know, format and genre and everything, and see what that looks like. Now, 2007 is where he hit it big, at least critically. Mm-hmm. And that was with Pushing Daisies.
Yes.
Now,
deservedly so.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us what that's about?
Yes. A young boy finds out that he has the power to bring back the dead by touching them. But then he also discovers, rather tragically, that he has the power to take their life again once he touches them again. And the premise of the pilot is you find out that he has made a happy life for himself being a pie maker. And then somebody finds out his secret and they decide to use it for fun and profit mainly. But he winds up being reunited with his long-lost childhood love. And it's one heck of a premise because he is, of course, he brings her back to life. And then he's put in the position of he can never, ever touch her under any circumstances whatsoever.
Yeah. This is very complex, you know, because there's also the element of if he brings someone back to life, then someone else dies, you know.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
It's like super complex. But
they have to be brought back to life for a certain duration. I think it's like 1 minute.
Yeah.
He has a
yeah.
minute to dispatch the other person.
Right.
Otherwise the scales balance. Yeah.
I mean, that's so complex. It's like it's like the infield fly rule or something like that.
No, it's like that. It's like that. Was it Twilight Zone story where I think it might have been New Twilight Zone. It was based on this story where there was a button, and if you pushed the button, it would kill somebody you didn't know, but you'd get money. And then they come and they take the box at the end, and they're like, well, this box is going to be given to somebody you don't even know. Sort
yeah.
of that type of premise.
Yeah, the box. That was a Richard Matheson story done
right.
as an episode of the New Twilight Zone, and then it was actually done as a movie.
No, it wasn't. That movie doesn't exist.
That movie's not terrible. It's a very
yes, it is.
Interesting premise. It's just, you know.
Done wrong?
Yeah.
In the movie? Yeah.
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 But, you know, what can you do?
Nothing.
but, yeah, Pushing Daisies. I enjoyed this. I enjoyed all of these pilots, you know, I have to say. But it's weird because, like, this one was directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who directed mm-hmm. Men in Black, Get Shorty. The new release Nine Lives, which I did see in Vegas when I was at the Star
Trek
convention,
which had a great Twitter account, Occupy Nine Lives, that was mocking everybody who was upset about Suicide Squad's bad reviews, because I believe it has an 8% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Although I'll tell you, the audience that I saw it with, which was on a Monday afternoon in Las Vegas, it was primarily lots and lots of seniors and lots of kids. It was a pretty full theater for 12 o'clock on a Monday afternoon in Las Vegas. But, oh my God, they loved it. I mean, applause at the end. I mean,
really?
Maybe we're not the target audience. And honestly, it's not terrible. You know, it's bad. It's bad, but it's mm-hmm. not terrible, you know?
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't watch it, but, you know. but the reason why I bring that up is because this is how much I love Barry Sonnenfeld, right? Get Shorty in particular, such a great movie. I just watched
yes, it
again like a week ago. I think that movie is close to being a comedic masterpiece, and a lot
yeah.
of that has to do with his direction. And he's kind of like earned this spot where I will watch anything that he does now just because of how great, you know, that movie is and some other stuff too. So Pushing Daisies, you know, super excited about this one. And, you know, I honestly did not like the pilot nearly as much as some of these others.
Really?
I think they were like just pushing things too far with the style. It's very, very sort of hyper real, you know, like the colors
yeah.
are just popping and the way the performances and the music and the narration and everything about it, it feels almost like a fairy tale, right? And,
well, it's supposed to.
Yeah, no, I know that that's what they were going for. And I don't know. how well that would work over the course of 2 years or whatever. And I know everyone says it works really, really well. To me, it's just I could take it in small doses. Like a 45-minute movie seemed perfect for that. I can't really see returning to this on a weekly basis. I will, and that's next on the docket for me, you know, because I finished Wonderfall, so now I'm going to watch Pushing Daisies. But, I definitely did not fall in love with it.
Interesting, because I fell completely in love with it.
Yeah.
This show, Pushing Daisies, is like a bullseye in my humor zone.
Yeah.
Okay. It's in terms of TV humor. I mean, movie humor, it'll never be better than Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. That's just top of the... And Odd Couple, the original one. Maybe the TV show Odd Couple. I don't know. But anyway, like, this is just a perfect show. I was their target demographic, whatever my brainwave pattern is, anything like that. I was not guffawing at anything. I wasn't slapping my knee, but I was just, it was a feeling of, and this is going to sound corny as hell, it was just a feeling of delight through the entire episode. I was just delighted with everything. I love the hyper-realistic and the hyper-color, you know, just how vibrant everything is. And again, it's taking a premise. And I think you see some of that, the hyper-saturation with the colors in Wonderfalls. But I think you see them take it and say, you know what, and just go for broke on this. And say, why not just oversaturate everything? And in that opening sequence where the kid's running through the CG-generated daisies, it's so yellow, and it's so vibrant, and it's so alive. And I think it's just wonderful. I love everything about this pilot. This isn't just, you know, boy, that was a good show and I look forward to it. This is, oh wow, this is going to be a binge watch.
Yeah. See, I mean, like, the way that you describe it is kind of the way that I felt about, like, Wonderfalls, to be honest, you know.
Okay.
Like, I think it's a bit more subdued and maybe a bit snarkier, you know. And I think that just kind of speaks to me a bit more, you know.
Okay.
This just seemed a little too crazy over the top for me. But I will definitely be watching it. And I'm very curious to see, because, like, you watch something like Wonderfalls or even something like Amazing Screw-On Head, and you kind of think, like, well, I know how an episode of that, I know how episode two will be structured, you know. But, like, Pushing Daisies, while it does a great job of setting up this premise and telling this story, like, it almost feels just like a 45-minute movie. And I honestly have no idea what episode two is going to be like. I have no idea. Which is kind of exciting, to be honest.
Yeah. Exactly. It is exciting.
Yeah. I'm curious to see what a normal episode of Pushing Daisies looks like. All right, so that was a critical success. In fact, he was nominated for an Emmy for his script for the pilot, and it lasted only a couple of years because nobody, you know, watches television, which is critically acclaimed, I guess. So unless it's on HBO,
you don't want the TV elites telling you what to think.
Yeah, right? I guess that's what it is. Yeah. So. There was a bit of a dry spell as far as Brian Fuller work from 2009 up until 2012. There was really nothing. He was working on Pushing Daisies and Heroes simultaneously somehow. I don't know. I guess their production schedules just, you know. So he was working on Heroes. He didn't create it. But the next show that he did create, the next pilot, which also failed. It was not picked up, although it was later aired as a Halloween special on NBC, was Mockingbird Lane.
Yes.
Which is a reboot of The Munsters, modernized, starring people like Jerry O'Connell and Eddie Izzard and Portia de Rossi. Mm-hmm. And it was directed by the other Brian, with a Y, Brian Singer. And yeah, what did you think of Mockingbird Lane? Yeah, I remember you telling me how much you loved it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's there. It is there.
Are you a Munsters fan to begin with?
Well, of course.
Okay.
Who couldn't be? I would say that Too Clever by Half is the way I would put this. They overshot whatever mark they were going for, and I just think they just don't land it. You know, like, I understand why this is the this is one of the flashes in the pan, where it's like, yeah, I get that. I understand.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I liked this a lot. I'm not like Munsters super fan, but I remember watching it as a kid and liking it. I certainly prefer the Munsters to the Addams Family. And
whoa! Now that's a bold statement.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with just circumstance. You know, like that was the one that was on TV at the particular time when I was watching TV or whatever.
Because Addams Family is some serious awesomeness.
Yeah, I mean the Munsters was the one that I sort of latched onto, and you know, seeing this sort of like updated version of it, I think is cool. I really did think it was funny. I really did like the style. I thought they landed the jokes. I thought the performances were really great, and I liked that it wasn't, you know, in any way, you know, sort of like slavish to the original. It was very much its own thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that it worked well in that regard. It felt very much like a Brian Fuller show, but it also felt like the Munsters. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you think like, why would someone, you know, I mean, I guess he hadn't done anything for a while, but like you figure he could do pretty much anything he wants, at least get a shot at it. And same thing for sure with Bryan Singer. Why would they want to do a remake of the Munsters? And I saw some interview with Fuller where he was talking about how when he was a kid, his two favorite shows, without a doubt, were Star Trek and the Munsters. And, you know, the reason was because they really spoke to him sort of on a philosophical level as a kid, you know, and how both of them were about sort of like being, you know, all-inclusive and everything like that, and sort of like just accepting of everything. You know, you've got Itik, and he's like the Munsters were completely accepting of everyone. They were all a bunch of, you know, like crazy monsters and, you know, freaks of nature. And yet they were like, come on in, you know, you're part of the family. And, you know, he said that, you know, as a kid who, you know, felt like an outcast, you know, it really sort of spoke to him and showed him, you know, like a group that he could be a part of in a sense, you know?
Yeah.
And I can definitely see that. Like after like reading that quote, everything sort of like clicked into place for me, because I can see why, you know, a kid would respond to something like that, you know, and why you would take that into your adulthood, you know. I didn't find that myself with the Munsters, but I could definitely see that with Star Trek, you know.
Sure.
So, you know, I mean, I can see why he would want to do this as sort of like a passion project, even though it seems like a really weird passion project. But, yeah, I mean, I liked it. I thought it was funny, and it had a cool premise, and I wish that they would have continued it. But I like the fact that it sort of exists as a Halloween special. You know, that seems like a throwback to another era too. You know, the idea of a Halloween special. So no, yeah.
Okay. We diverge.
All right,
we diverge, good sir.
Fair enough. Okay, so there's one more.
Yes, there is, Mike.
There
is one more, Mike. There's one more.
Yes, and that is Hannibal.
Yes.
Which is based on the novel Red Dragon by Thomas Harris.
Yes.
About the character of Hannibal Lecter.
No. The book is about Will Graham.
The book is, yeah, for sure.
His pursuit of Francis Dolarhyde.
Mm-hmm.
But this, very cleverly, takes the premise of the history that existed between Will Graham and Hannibal Lecter and explores that more than the story that they have adapted twice for the big screen. In an attempt to get Francis's.
One and a half times, let's be fair.
Okay, I'll give you that. I'll give you that.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like a prequel to the book, at least yes. at the start. The pilot is. The pilot is, at least.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, what do you think about Hannibal?
What do you think I think? What do you think I think about the pilot for Hannibal? I was excited about this show because I heard making, you know, updated adaptation of Thomas Harris's, you know, Red Dragon. I was like, intrigued, go on. And I watched rewatched this pilot for this. And it's amazing. It's incredible. It's everything that I would want in a suspenseful, philosophical show that is on television. Like, if you're going to ask for an hour of my life, you better give me something worthwhile. And this gave me something worthwhile. This gave the world something worthwhile. And it was innovative with its visuals, with its approach to the subject, with its approach to the characters, with its approach to casting, everything. This is an amazing pilot. It's an amazing series. I'll grant that it gets a little difficult to stick with it in the third season. But well worth it. And I defy anybody to watch this pilot and not say, wow, I can't wait to watch this show. So what did you think, Mike?
Yeah, I agree. Now, I have only watched the pilot, but I've watched it twice now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I haven't read the books, but I'm a big fan of the original trilogy, as I like to call it, Manhunter, Silence of the Lambs, and Hannibal. And I was excited to see this show. I didn't watch it when it was first on because I was busy with other things. But I really, really love the pilot, and it is so different from everything else that he's done, and yet it still feels like something that he's done. You know, mm-hmm. you get that fuller voice, even though it's not at all comedic. But you can tell that he has a love for the source material in the same way that he had a love for the source material in, you know, Mockingbird Lane and Amazing Screw-On Head, I would say, you know?
Sure.
But, yeah, I mean, I think that it is a real interesting premise. I think the performances are fantastic. It looks amazing.
Yes.
You know, the direction is directed by David Slade, who has made a number of movies, some of which are good and some of which are not. But you know what he made, which I love? He directed the music video for Stone Temple Pilots' Sour Girl.
What?
With the freaky Teletubby things and
I know the one you're talking about. Yeah, yeah.
Oh my god, that's such a great video. Anyway,
it kind of is. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's a really, really great pilot, and I really can't wait to watch the rest of it. I want to power through Pushing Daisies as quickly as I can, just so that I can get to Hannibal.
Gonna warn you, totally different feel between those two shows. Like, if you put this pilot versus pilot, I think you can already tell these shows go down different roads.
Yeah, they seem kind of different. Although, I will say this about all of the pilots. You know, I mean, even though they are very, very distinct, you know, they all have their own very distinct feel and everything, there do seem to be, like, a lot of themes running through them. The big mm-hmm. one, which I see, which is in almost all of them, except for maybe Wonderfalls, is death. You know?
Mortality is on his mind.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, bringing things back to life and, you know, all this stuff. I mean, you see it again and again and again. And he does it comedically, but everything is about death. And, yeah. You know, and it's weird because people always say, like, I'm excited about Brian Fuller, you know, creating the new Star Trek show because you look at his shows and they're incredibly optimistic. And I guess in a way they are. I know like the thing that people always cite is like Pushing Daisies, right? But you know, in a way they are.
I'm going to argue the point about Hannibal.
Okay.
That's not quite as optimistic as you might think.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I think that there's also this sort of like underpinning to them, which is just like, we're all going to die, you know? So let's make the most of it, right?
Well, okay. See, I don't want to blow anything with Hannibal, but
yeah, don't do that, please.
I don't want to, but I will say that looking at it that way, you could make the argument that there's an optimism in the show Hannibal about the fact that you fight almost that sense, almost like Sam from Lord of the Rings, where it's like, even when it's dark, you keep fighting because it's about hope.
Yeah.
You keep pushing no matter what. And so there is that theme in Hannibal where it's almost like Seven, where, like, you know, Morgan Freeman's character has been beaten down, but he's not going to stop fighting the evil. He's not going to stop going out there and wading into that city every day because somebody needs to do it.
Yeah.
So there is that sense to it. Something heroic about it. I'll be very interested to see where on the Fuller Rainbow Discovery falls. I know it's not going to go down the Pushing Daisies road, right? I kind of would be very intrigued by a Hannibal road, but I think that's going to be a really tough sell to Trek fans.
It's not. I mean, like, just like hearing things that he said going all the way back to like 2009, where he was talking about, like, I want to do a show set in the JJ verse that's on like another ship, like the Reliant or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And talking about how, like, it sounds like the one through line through like all the different ideas that he's had, like maybe the next generation in the JJ verse or whatever, all the different, you know, sort of like incarnations of Star Trek that he's come up with. The thing which seems to be a constant is recreating the tone of the original series, recreating the sense of exploration, adventure, you know, excitement, optimism, you know, all that stuff. And I really think that whatever we get is not going to be, we're not going to do like the Dark Knight for Star Trek. We're going to get sort of a return to optimism. You know what I mean?
You can have optimism as your through line, but at the same time, maybe throw out that, and you know, we talked about potential like character conflicts based on some of the stuff that's been said. Like, you can look at it in the terms of a, you know, optimism is your through line, but there's conflict between the characters, like throwing out that old show Bible of everybody's got to be lovey-dovey, pat on the back, nobody fights on the crew, to something a little more Battlestar Galactica, if you will, where everybody, there's a drive and there's hope and there's, you know, this goal, but people still are people trying to work things out along the way. I mean, the original show had that. There's optimism in the original show, but they still had a member of the crew who was, you know, pretty much called racist and, you know, all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, and I think that there will be that for sure. You know, I mean, I do think that there will be some, you know, conflict and everything, and, you know, they're probably going to deal with some pretty, you know, heavy stuff, of course. But I think at the same time, like, I'm kind of envisioning the tone of this thing being closer to something like Firefly almost, you know, maybe not quite as jokey, you know, but I think this is going to be more Marvel movie than DC movie. You know what I mean? Like, it's definitely going to have like a sense of fun. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So probably more, I mean, I would put Wonder Falls somewhere between Pushing Daisies and Hannibal.
Everything, it's not going to be, every show ever made is tonally between Pushing Daisies and Hannibal.
No, you know what I'm saying, though. Nice. You know what I'm saying. Like,
Yeah.
I
mean, I'm going to say, like, if looking at these six things, if I had to guess as to, like, what would be closest in tone, probably Dead Like Me. But I don't think that it's going to be similar to that tone, you know? I don't know. I think one of the things that we see here is that he doesn't do just one thing. He's not a one-trick pony or anything like that. He adapts his style to the material, you know? And I think it's going to be unlike anything that we've seen in his filmography, you know? I don't know. I'm excited.
I think these are definitely a compass of sorts to point us in the direction, but
it won't
be a precise spotting. I agree with you.
No. Yeah. So, okay. looking at these six, if you're the network executive and mm-hmm. and you've seen all six of these pilots and you've yes. only got one slot, you know, mm-hmm. Thursday night at 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock? Well, that's a totally different conversation.
Central time. Central time.
Well, that's 8 o'clock.
Okay, Eastern. Okay, fine. Let's push it back to 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock.
Okay, Eastern. Now the conversation is back where I want it to be.
Okay, yes. All right. What is your pick?
Hannibal.
Okay.
Are you kidding? At the end of Hannibal, I don't just want to green light the show. I want to beat new episodes out of them before they leave the room. Yeah. Don't leave me hanging like this.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that Hannibal is definitely the best and definitely has the most potential, which, you know, you tell me, like, they're gonna making a Hannibal show and my on you know, network television, and my first reaction is, really? Like, you're that, okay. Oh.
He pushes guys. Some boundaries, Mike.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, that pilot is definitely R-rated. It's like, how did they get this on
the pilot
television?
Does not prepare you for what's coming.
Okay, all right. Yeah. It's crazy to think that they got that on network television. But
I forget which episode number it is, but there is an episode where my wife looked at me and said, how is this on television? And I looked at her and I said, I don't know.
Yep. That's how it goes. It's really good. I mean, I like I said, I like all of these, you know, but Hannibal definitely is the best.
What's the number? Let's take Hannibal. Okay, Hannibal doesn't air before 10 o'clock, period. End of sentence. Okay. Mm-hmm. No more discussion. Let's say we have to pick, we'll go back with you. We'll pick the 8 p.m. Real People time slot. And 7 o'clock for you. Uh-huh. What show gets the green light?
I'm going to say Wonderfalls. Yeah. Yeah, that's my number two for sure.
I got to go Pushing Daisies based on the pilots.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I figured you were going to say that. And I think probably most people would. But for me, yeah, I don't know. Wonderfalls just, you know, kind of hits a sweet spot in the same way that that you were saying, you know, Pushing Daisies mm-hmm. does for you, you know.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
So he's got, we're going to see two pilots from Brian Fuller next year, you know, Disco, like we've been talking about, but also American Gods, which is based on a Neil Gaiman book. And he's co-creating that with Michael Green. And they've already shot, I think, most, if not all, of the first season. It's going to be on Stars. Sounds like it's going to be rather intense. It sounds like the book is rather intense. I haven't read the book. Have you?
Nope.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it really is sort of like an exploration of religions, you know. I mean, not one in particular, but all of them, you know, and sort of like, you know, the idea of faith and all that stuff. But, you know, from the creator of Sandman. So I saw the trailer. Did you see the trailer?
No, I haven't watched the trailer yet.
It looks pretty cool. The cast is amazing. He's got everyone from Gillian Anderson to is Crispin Glover in this movie, in this show? I want to say he is.
If so, I think I gotta check and make sure I have Stars then, because
I know, right?
You know, you're getting something special with him.
And it's gonna, you know, it's gonna be crazy. Gillian Anderson, Emily Browning, Dane Cook is in it, Cloris Leachman, Ian McShane. So yeah, so it's exciting, and the fact that we've got two more shows, you know, coming right up are really cool. We're definitely going to have to talk. I mean, obviously, we're going to be talking about Disco, but also you know, American Gods when that comes on. We'll definitely have to talk about that too. Yeah. So yeah, any final thoughts on Brian Fuller's?
If you have Amazon Prime, go now, watch Hannibal, and. The CW Seed app, you can actually watch Pushing Daisies for free. And I guess we should give everybody the list of everywhere they can find these things, right? You can find Dead Like Me on Amazon Prime. Yeah. Wonderfalls, you have to purchase the DVD, but I would say, Mike, it's worth the money, yes?
I would definitely say so. It's only like $20 on Amazon, so why not?
Come on, that's like the price of two coffees at Starbucks. You can afford it. The Amazing Screw-On Head is available out
it's
there.
On, On DVD. You can get it on DVD.
It is. Pushing Daisies is on the CW Seed app, which is actually a very well-made app.
It was a little glitchy when it switches to commercials and stuff like that, but for a free, you know, streaming television service, I mean, hey, why not?
Yeah, don't pause during the commercial. I found that one out the hard way.
Yeah, and they've got like all of Pushing Daisies on there, and they got a lot of other cool shows on there too, like The OC and Constantine and stuff like that. So yeah, check it out. It's free, why not?
Yeah. Mockingbird Lane might be re-aired at Halloween sometime. I don't know.
In the meantime, used to be able to get it off of like iTunes or whatever, and they pulled it, so it's not available anywhere now, which is unfortunate.
Well, we should start a letter writing campaign.
There you go.
Trek fans are good at that, Mike.
Yeah, you should lead the charge. I know you.
I will do that. I will when I get around to it. I will let you know.
All right.
And of course, Amazon Prime is also home to Hannibal, the great, wonderful Hannibal.
Which you can usually get for really cheap on Blu-ray as well.
And features a star of the upcoming Star Wars Rogue One.
Oh, yeah. What's the name?
Something Ursa.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's a guy who figures out the thing that makes the Death Star work. That's not a spoiler. That's officially out there. I did not spoil that. For anybody. If I know it, the world knows it.
Yeah, so go out, find these shows, watch them all, well worth it. Let us know what you think the best pilot that he's made is. Which one would you greenlight? So in the meantime, John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing, and you can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig Sorrell. And my screen name is Kessel Junkie. I'm not really locked down anywhere right now. You'll just have to find me. Where can they find you, Mike?
You can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, and you can also find me here on Trek FM producing From There to Here, Trek FM's 50th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek. Okay, this is the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. Like we said, you know, we wanted to do this because of that, to celebrate, happy 50. Let's talk about stuff which isn't Star Trek. Hopefully we can make this like a yearly thing where we adopt this format on September 8th every year. We'll see how that goes. However, tomorrow, September 9th, if you're listening to this the day it comes out, is a Friday, and we will be back with a normal episode of Stage 9, where we're going to take a look at the work of Star Trek's very first writer, or the Mantrap's writer, the very first episode that aired 50 years ago today, The Mantrap. It was written by George Clayton Johnson. And he was one of the writers of Ocean's 11, the original. So we're going to take a look tomorrow at the original Ocean's 11 and also all of the movies which it has spawned, and talk a little bit about the upcoming incarnation of Ocean's 11, Ocean's Ocho.